This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about a tricky subject, one I've been wrestling with myself for a long time. That subject is patriotism, and here to discuss it with me is Patrick Coy, one of the co-authors of an interesting book, especially for activists. It's called Contesting Patriotism, Culture, Power, and Strategy in the Peace Movement. Patrick Coy, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. Happy to be here. I've enjoyed your programs in the past, so I'm happy to be part of it.
Oh, you're too kind. You are the director at the Center for Applied Conflict Management at Kent State. How long have you been there?
I've been here 14 years at Kent State and been the director for about 6 or 7 years, I guess.
What's it like to teach conflict management at Kent State, which is still synonymous in so many of our minds with the massacre of students there almost 40 years ago? Does that still cast a shadow over there?
It certainly does. As a matter of fact, our program is a direct result of the shooting. So after the shootings in 1970 by the Ohio National Guard, a commission was set up to study how the university should respond as an institution, and it came back with a consensus recommendation that they should set up a center to promote peaceful mechanisms of social and political change. And so that's how we got our start, and we are what's called a living memorial to the students killed by the Ohio National Guard. And so we enroll a pretty big program here. We got over 1,000 students in our courses every academic year, and I run a full undergraduate major and minor in what's called applied conflict management.
And on the date of the anniversary of Kent State, is there a memorial service there every year?
There is a commemoration on the night before. There's a candlelight march, silent march all through campus the night before. Then there's a vigil all through the night at the spots where the four students died, a 24-hour silent vigil. And then the next day there's a commemoration and a program, speakers and music and the like. And then we also have an academic conference that's usually the week before that deals with more conceptual and theoretical questions about the relationship between democracy and dissent and protest and the like.
And you yourself, how did you get involved in peace activism? Do you consider yourself an activist, and how'd that get going?
I consider myself an activist, and it got going during the Vietnam War in the city in which you live, at Madison, when I was a student there in the early 1970s. I got active in the peace movement there. Fortunately, had a high lottery number and was able to avoid service that way, and have been active in various kinds of ways ever since, including 7 years with the Catholic Worker Movement, living in community in St. Louis, and then probably about 15 years or so on and off the National Council of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, including as their national chair, and active in some local groups as well.
And why did you take the route to academia then?
You know, I always wanted to be a teacher, and I kind of always felt that that's what I was good at and could succeed at, and took a roundabout way to become an academic. I started, doing a secondary education degree and never, in fact, taught high school, and then went into peace and justice education at St. Louis University, kind of outside the classroom, directing their peace and justice education program, and then decided, I really wanted to be an academic, and so went and got the PhD, and thankfully Kent State hired me.
There you have it. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio, and I'm talking to Patrick Coy, who's the director at the Center for Applied Conflict Management at Kent State University and the co-author with Lynn Worley. Is that how you pronounce her name?
That's right.
And Gregory Maney of
yes.
Contesting Patriotism, Culture, Power, and Strategy in the Peace Movement. Why is this concept of patriotism so important? Or dealing with the concept?
Right. Well, it's so important because it's a foundational idea when we organize ourselves into a thing called a state. And one of the things that happens when we become a country, or when a group of people decides to become a country, is that we begin to equate the people with the state. So there's this sort of idea that the nation, the people, are the state, that they're synonymous in some way, and that the people have a responsibility to support the state because the state is there to protect them and to ensure their security and to help them ensure their livelihood and the like. And so patriotism really gets to foundational issues of identity, not just national identity, but individual identity as it connects with the state and with the nation. And so we understood that patriotism was foundational. So we thought, well, if that's the case, why don't we study it during war? That's when it will be most important to understand what patriotism looks like and feels like and tastes like and sounds like. And so what we did was collected the official statements of 15 major U.S. peace movement organizations across five recent conflict periods, five recent U.S. wars, from the Gulf War to the no-fly zone bombings of Iraq in 98, to the Kosovo bombings by NATO, to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11, and then the first 2 years of the Iraq War. And so we looked at that data, the statements of these organizations during times of war, when patriotism becomes even more important. And we thought that that would be a way to even understand it to a greater extent.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this foundational idea of patriotism. It's not natural. You're not born with it from birth in the crib or something. I mean, unless we immigrate, we don't actually organize ourselves into a state. We're born into a state, and then we're inculcated with these ideologies about the state that are called patriotism and sometimes nationalism. And it's a tricky thing. It's a tricky thing for me anyway, because I'm kind of not unpatriotic, but anti-patriotic, in that I'm so distrusting of the power of the concept of patriotism and the danger of the concept of nationalism that I shy away from calling myself patriotic. And yet I know, and you and your co-authors deal with this question in the book at some length in different places, that on a tactical basis, certainly if you're going to convince your fellow citizens here, the overwhelming percentage of, and I don't know if you have poll data on this, Patrick Coy, but the overwhelming percentage of Americans, I imagine, identify themselves as patriotic. And so it's hard to go straight at that concept, and yet sometimes I think it's necessary to go straight at that concept. So to what extent do you think it's necessary, or did these peace groups go at it?
Right. Well, you're exactly right, Matt, that we're not born as patriots. We are socialized into our relationship with our own governments. That socialization process is, almost hegemonic. It's all pervasive, and we by and large take a lot of that socialization somewhat uncritically. So if that's the case, then, and you're right that most poll numbers would show that the overwhelming majority of Americans are highly patriotic, then what do you do during the times of war when patriotism is even stronger? And what we found in our study was that the peace movement addresses this question by moving back and forth along a continuum. So at some points, at certain moments, these peace movement organizations will confront patriotism, and they'll say, look, patriotism is dangerous, just like you said, Matt, that it can be used for negative, destructive kinds of purposes, and it's a dangerous concept and a construct. And so they try to deconstruct it and say patriotism is not the answer. Globalism is the answer. So that would be an example of a peace movement saying, look, let's go right up against the patriotic concept, deconstruct it, and put in its place something else called globalism, for example, that I'm a global citizen, and that's more important. That's more foundational. Now, when would a peace movement do that? Well, they might do that when there's more political opening. So, for example, after 9/11, when there was very little political opening and Americans were hyper-patriotic, we found that peace movements were very careful. They didn't challenge this hegemonic notion of patriotism very much, but what they did was they harnessed it. And they said, let's t- talk about patriotism in a new way. And let's say that patriotism doesn't mean blind obedience to the Bush administration policies, but it means that we're lovingly critical of our country and its principles, and we want it to be true to its principles. So they would be very critical of the policies, but put those criticisms in the spectrum of the patriotic duty of a citizen. So you can challenge these notions, or you can harness their power. It's kind of sort of like a jiu-jitsu experience, you know. You go up against a more powerful opponent. You want to stand up against them, they're going to just bowl you over. So you use the force of the concept of patriotism, turn it around, and use the weight of that concept to convince people of a different point of view. And so we call that harnessing that kind of hegemonic notion. And we saw the peace movement doing both harnessing and challenging, depending upon the political opening that they faced, which means that the peace movement was somewhat adaptable and strategic in its rhetoric.
But in that harnessing, for instance, I mean, the clear example is the poster or the slogan or the bumper sticker, peace is patriotic. In using that slogan, maybe even just the use of that slogan inadvertently fuels, as you suggest in one place in the book, or at least say that critics would say that it inadvertently fuels the concept of nationalism that is so all-pervasive in this culture. And so that's what makes it tricky right there, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you harness these hegemonic concepts that can be used for destructive purposes, you run the risk of reinforcing them. And B, from a peace movement, you know, an activist point of view, you also run the risk of alienating your sort of traditional supporters. And so, what we found, I mean, this is a very empirical study. We collected all of the statements of all of these organizations across these five conflict periods, and we analyzed them qualitatively and quantitatively with statistical approaches to find out, exactly what was being said. And what we found was that even during 9/11, for example, when the peace movement, because the hyper-patriotic period, even then when they were harnessing these notions, they were also issuing statements that challenged them. Okay, so they're trying to sort of speak to two audiences at the same time and counterbalance the danger of making use of this concept by also challenging it at a later point in their statement. So there's a fidelity as well to these traditional values that would see patriotism as being potentially destructive, and also an adaptability by using it strategically.
Patrick Coy is my guest today on Progressive Radio. He's the co-author of Contesting Patriotism, Culture, Power, and Strategy in the Peace Movement. I guess the flip side of the adaptability coin is opportunism or pandering, and that is some people who might invoke the concept of patriotism may not actually believe in it. And so then there's a question of integrity and justifying the means. And did you get a sense from any of these organizations on that, or any in your interpersonal interactions with activists, how they dealt with that?
I wouldn't say that we found examples of pandering, but we found examples of, you know, very what appeared to be very strategic choices. So again, for example, during, you know, we had some data that indicated that George W. Bush, you know, was one of the most religious presidents in U.S. history in terms of the amount of religious language in his discourse, right? And so what we also discovered was that in response to that the religious language of the U.S. peace movement jumped up precipitously during the immediate 9/11 period and during the first 2 years of the Iraq War when George Bush was in office. Even the secular groups, Matt, like the War Resisters League, for example, were using religious language during this period. Now, they used them in a different kind of way, by co-opting figures like Reverend Martin Luther King, or by, quoting King's language that has a more sort of generic spiritual appeal. And I wouldn't call that pandering so much as I would call that, because on a creative, strategic, good thinking approach to how can we enter into this landscape of argument during this time of war, when religious language is being thrown all over the place. How can we also enter into it? And they could do it by, you know, harnessing an iconic religious figure, by Reverend Martin, like Reverend King, who's widely accepted.
And the example you use in this book, Contesting Patriotism, the King example, Bush was foolish enough to invoke King's name as almost a justification for the Iraq War. I think it was a Martin Luther King Day celebration. So there was an opening that the peace movement was glad to plow through. But Martin Luther King is a good example. In many of his speeches, and most notably in the I Have a Dream speech, he invokes the American dream. He talks about America and the highest values of America, and is really playing those chords of America. But that is he does it a little differently, though, in his Riverside Church speech in 1967, where he says the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and he kind of, so to use your terms, the first one he was harnessing, the second one he was challenging.
That's right. That's right. And so when somebody like President Bush, tries to use King in a way to support these, military adventurous policies, it's a double-edged sword for him, as you say, because he creates an opening for the peace movement to turn that around use it to critique Bush. Similarly, for example, we found, George Bush and other presidents would try to use the support the troops notion, which is so powerful and so pervasive in the United States today in particular, and would kind of use the troops and play on the sympathy of support for the troops to support the policies, that's a double-edged sword as well. We found that, for example, during the Gulf War, that the peace movement responded to that by expanding this web of concern. So they said, yes, we should support the troops as well. The troops are worthy of being supported. But a great nation like ours, a great country like the United States, ought to also care about the civilian casualties that our policies are creating. We ought to also care about the environment that our wars are impacting negatively. We ought to also care about the military families. We ought to also care about the poverty draft. Okay, so they expanded the web of concern beyond the troops, harnessing that notion of, we ought to support the troops, but we ought to support others as well. And then during the Iraq War, we found that the peace movement took it to another level. They were really ready for this support the troops idea, and they turned it back on the president, on George Bush, very pronounced. We found like 17 different examples of what we called the discourse of betrayal that the peace movement articulated. That Bush betrayed the troops in terms of equipment. He betrayed them in terms of medical care. He betrayed them in terms of educational promises. 17 different manifestations of the discourse of betrayal. So they turned the notion back on the president. And so it's a double-edged sword when a politician takes these tropes or these pervasive constructs and ideas like patriotism or democracy or freedom or support the troops and uses them for policies because they can be turned back against them. And the peace movement did this quite regularly.
And one way it's been doing it is support the troops, bring them home, of course. But it may also be a double-edged sword for peace activists because you mentioned the Gulf War. To say support the troops during the Gulf War when the troops were engaged in a turkey shoot from the air, just mowing down tens of thousands of retreating Iraqis barefooted and who dropped their weapons is a tricky, bordering on immoral thing to say. Similarly, after Abu Ghraib, are you going to say support the troops? So that, and we had this in Vietnam too with My Lai. I mean, then to say support the troops is tricky. And of course, a lot of the support the troops language is a reaction to the stereotype of what happened to troops coming back from Vietnam, that they were spat on and treated disrespectfully, and some may have been. And so I know the peace movement has been hypersensitive to that. But it's tricky in its own right, isn't it, Patrick?
It is tricky, and the example you give of the Gulf War, Matt, questionable behavior and potential war crimes committed in terms of treatment of retreating troops and civilian casualties and the like. The peace movement wasn't as ready to engage the troops issue during the Gulf War. Remember, this is the first sort of quote-unquote major war since Vietnam. And it's the first sort of major war since the Rambo films and since the Hollywood notions about how the troops were mistreated by the peace movement during the Vietnam era. And the peace movement was kind of caught unawares. And also the Gulf War was a relatively short war. So we found very little criticism of the troops during the Gulf War. You're right, Matt. They ignored it. They weren't ready for it. But they got hit over the head so hard with that during the Gulf War that by the time the Iraq War came along, we found that the peace movement was, and again, this is empirical data from their statements, we found that they were ready for this. They did proactive and anticipatory kind of framing. They were not only harnessing the troops in that notion of support and using it for the discourse of betrayal I mentioned, but they were also openly negative of the behavior, for example, at Abu Ghraib, and with regard to the treatment of Iraqi civilians and the disruption of Iraqi family life, these kinds of things.
One thing, torture. Patrick Coy, one thing that surprised me in your book, Contesting Patriotism, which you co-wrote with two other authors, subtitled Culture, Power, and Strategy in the Peace Movement, was that, I mean, I understood after 9/11 that the idea of confronting patriotism, challenging patriotism, given the fear and the fact that we were attacked and the horrible deaths that happened would be kind of impossible or very tricky in any event, difficult, delicate. But the Iraq War, which was such a bogus and obviously bogus war, I would have thought that there would have been a bigger opening and that the challenges, the direct confrontation with notions of patriotism and nationalism would have been greater than, say, during the Gulf War, but actually that wasn't true.
It wasn't true in terms of the challenging.
Right.
No, actually, there was more challenging of patriotism in the Iraq War statistically than there was during the Gulf War. There definitely was. In fact, there was a, you know, that was the highest level of challenging that we had was during, and remember, our data for the Iraq War was only the first 2 years of the Iraq War. But here we saw the peace movement, take the president, take the policies head on. But what was interesting, Matt, is that not only did they do that, but they kind of learned from the 9/11 period when they had to harness these concepts that was effective. And so they kept doing it while they also challenged. We argue that shows also a kind of, you know, an interesting learning curve by a social movement over time. Because the peace movement is a movement that's sort of ideologically based and identity based and values based, like most social movements, right? And so there's been, I think, a resistance to harness these ideas, just like the kinds of questions that you're asking. But once during 9/11, they found that it could be potentially effective, they kept doing it even while during Iraq. They ramped up their challenging because the political opening allowed them to do it. Because the Iraq War, as you say, was not as supportable as the invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11. You know, after 9/11, George Bush had the second highest approval rating of any president in U.S. history. He went from about 51% approval to, I think it was 89%. It was a 38% bump, the largest bump of, you know, rally around the flag that we have in American polling data. So given that, that was a really unique period for peace movements to try to organize and mobilize.
Patrick Coy, what about the flag? What about peace activists waving the flag, capturing the flag, if you will, which is the old game? Is that recommended?
Depends who you ask, I suppose. I think you see, I mean, my anecdotal experience with that would be that you see many more American flags used in peace movement rallies than one used to, and I think it reflects this response to the new political environment, and maybe a some would say, you know, a more strategic approach. It also reflects learning from past mistakes, I think. Whether it's good or not, you know, I think the answer is it depends. We have a picture on the cover of our book of a peace movement march in Syracuse, New York during the Iraq War, and it's a red, white, and blue banner that says "Peace is patriotic" on it. That's a flag of a different sort, using the national colors, that suggests a flag without flying the flag itself. So there's a lot of ways to go at that problem.
I mean, I'm reminded of my predecessor, Irwin Knoll, the longtime editor at The Progressive, who every July 4th would have a party, but instead of flying the American flag, he would tack up a copy of the Bill of Rights. And in his honor, on every July 4th, I fly a flag, but it's not the American flag, it's a Bill of Rights flag. But that's idiosyncratic, to be sure. And
right. Well, my wife and I have a flag on our deck. It's out there 365 days a year, and it's a flag of, you know, a picture of the Earth taken from space. Hmm. And that's our flag, you know, so that's the kind of global citizen idea.
Let's get at that in the last 2 minutes that we have here, Patrick Coy, because you write in your book, Contesting Patriotism, about the civic religion that is patriotism in the United States, and there's a civic litany that we're all supposed to recite, which is, you know, America's the greatest country in the world, we're the shining city on the hill, we're the greatest country there ever was, the greatest democracy. How do you respond to that? And do you cop to that?
Right. That's an interesting question, because it's one of the things that I often talk about in my classes is I try to create a problem over this idea that we are the greatest democracy. I mean, this is a trope that you know, we're all fed all through our lives, that in fact we're the greatest democracy. It's sort of unquestioned. And any kind of, you know, honest critical analysis would say that no, we're far from the greatest democracy. We're actually a very poor manifestation of democracy when you look at it in a comparative perspective. This majority approach in terms of our government, the lack of citizen participation, even in voting, much less in other elements of democratic life, tells us that we have a long way to go. And so the peace movement said, you know, when Bush is trying to export democracy, they said, well, you know, let's look at what democracy means. Democracy means being accountable to the will of the people. And during the Iraq War, the will of the people was unsupportive of this war. And so they tried to, turn that idea of, if we're a democracy, let's have democratic accountability on policymaking. It's a set of beliefs that, you know, come with empire, that we're the greatest this and we're the greatest that, and that we have a responsibility to export these ideas, even though we may not be very good manifestations of them.
And if we deny them, we're almost excommunicated, to stick with the religious metaphor. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Patrick Coy, thanks for being my guest today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for doing the program and keeping that great magazine alive, Matt.
Oh, you're quite welcome. We do what we can. Patrick Coy's book is called Contesting Patriotism. He's the co-author, Culture, Power, and Strategy in the Peace Movement.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.